Social media is something that gives us a voice. It gives us an opportunity to communicate in ways and at scale that we never could before. It also provides brands a platform to communicate with customers at mass scale they couldn't before either. One-to-one connections, mass connections, et cetera. It also gives foreign powers a platform to manipulate domestic policy. And as we found in the last year, there have been a lot of really interesting and self-reflective moments in social media as well. And the reason I bring that up is if we're going to be talking about the future of social media, we should start with an assessment of where we are today. What's the actual status of social media in the world that we live in? So the first thing is, we're not in Kansas anymore. Not to beat an analogy to death, every single deck starts off like this when it comes to technology, but we were kind of humming along the road of social media. Everything was great, everything was awesome. We were able to make people a fan of a cookie. We could create really cool viral videos, and we were able to make media dollars go a lot farther. But all of a sudden, things started to happen, and then this hammer dropped. Yeah, the room just went cold, man. Anybody remember this guy? Christopher Wiley blew the whistle on Cambridge Analytica, and all of a sudden, things kind of started to come up. We knew that there were interesting things going on in social media in general, but when the hammer really dropped, all of a sudden, we kind of had to hit pause and say, wait a minute. Social media does a lot of good, and it amplifies all the best of us, but that's the thing about technology. It amplifies all of the best as well as all of the worst, and there are elements of design that actually go into making this possible. Now, I love this GIF because it shows a lot of what Zuckerberg's all about, but it's also turning the tide. It's turning the tide in tech. So for those, for many, many years, we've had this love affair with social media, with technology, the Googles, the Facebooks of the world. They were transforming the world as we knew it. They're completely reshaping the way we communicate with our friends, our families, loved ones, people we didn't know. But all of a sudden, the world was turned upside down, and we realized, wow, this has a lot more power than we ever realized. And as a result, we're starting to see some social movement around this. Now, everyone's kind of still using Facebook the same way they were a couple of weeks ago. Has anybody deleted their Facebook profile here? One person. That's about two. That's actually more than I expected to see. So that's kind of the way things are going, but what we'll probably see from this is some new upstarts actually challenging the status quo. Like we did with the Allo Network and a few others. But I don't think anything's really going to take enough traction to take down the big boys like Facebook. We're too addicted. We like it too much. And if anyone remembers the big hubbub around Axiom's About the Data a few years back, what they did is Axiom, after coming under fire, allowed consumers to access the data that Axiom had about them specifically. And what you could do, actually remove yourself from the system and opt out of certain things, or you could do what the vast majority of people did when they had access to Axiom, correct the data. The people who logged into Axiom, after seeing what data this company had on them, decided to say, that's not right, let me give you the answer to that one. So the companies that we are always throwing stones at for knowing too much about us, for being Big Brother, for being part of this mesh of technology that's the technology overlord, we're actually willing to say, I'll help you out. In the name of a more personalized experience, in the name of more efficient experiences online, I will give you this information. So, do I really expect much to come from this? Another change is tech's place in government. Tech is now one of the largest sectors of lobbying within government as far as dollars spent. Now that's a big deal because they now know they have to play the game just like any other large multinational corporation, like an oil company or a financial sector. Now this is a very different place than they were 10 years ago when they were the star child and nothing could touch them. They were specifically trying to go outside of regulation so that they could create new opportunities, and they did. Another thing. Two of our tech darlings are now on America's top 20 most hated brands. Not something we would have seen company a couple years ago. So my question with this is, are tech companies on their way to becoming public utilities? Who here loves their telco? How about your energy provider? Your airline? Well, maybe you would have said that 20 years ago, 50 years, 100 years ago. When Ma Bell started actually providing telephones to people across the nation, they not only reshaped the way we communicate, they reshaped geography itself within the country. Now that's called transformation. This is something that people got excited about. They were also worried about what it could do, But it's the same type of excitement and change, the societal change that we're seeing with these social networks and with technology companies. And there's a pretty good argument to be made for this, given the fact that there's already a movement around making internet connectivity a basic human right. How do you separate that from the argument around social media and say, social media, something so intertwined into the connectivity that we actually ascribe with internet connectivity, is different than the human right of accessing the internet? That's a really hard thing to do. So that's something that we're looking at from an industry perspective. Things have changed a lot. We're definitely not in Kansas anymore. Now let's start taking a look at the marketer's playbook, our playbook, what we've been doing for the last 5 or 6 years on social media, this thing that we've loved so much, that's brought us so many great connections and an opportunity to speak with our consumers. Well, we started with this idea that marketers should become more like media companies, and that worked for a while. We've got brands like Red Bull that are the poster child of having all sorts of assets everywhere. They're a content publisher to the nth degree, and they're not really, depending on where you look, but they're actually more of a media brand than a soft drink brand in many ways. But that got quashed in many ways by the destruction of organic reach. Facebook's a pay-to-play platform. Twitter's also run by algorithms. So is Instagram. And then you take a look at the content playbook. Make great content and it'll get shared. But if you take a look at what's happening on some of the greatest websites for content specifically, places like Copyblogger, Social Media Examiner, and Buffer that are designed to help people spread content, they've seen their own reach within social referral traffic drop by 50% or more. And this is what they do. So when you take a look at content, it's going to cost more and more to create the great content that we want people to see over time. And as more content rushes out there, our attention span is still finite, so we're basically battling for that attention span. It's going to cost more to create the great content that we need, essentially changing the economics of content. And I love this quote from Michael Schaefer. We are at an era of advertising where promotion distribution strategies may eclipse the importance of the content itself. Now, it's kind of ironic because aren't we back at the start of what social media was actually pulling us away from? Social media was one of the first places you could go where you didn't have to spend advertising dollars to reach your community, to shape a community. And now all of a sudden we're back at the same place. It'd be a familiar territory to this group. Except for the dude with the pumpkin. I don't know what his deal is. I was fired before the pilot ever aired. But the reason I also show this one is because if you take a look at what's happening in social media today and with technology, these guys may be great at the amplification and actually selling you a concept, but they wouldn't recognize 70% of the stuff that we do today. Think about that for a second. Probably more than that. So what does the future of social media look like? We've kind of established that things have changed quite a bit from the industry as well as our playbooks. We have a lot fewer resources to do what we aspired to do years ago, and it's getting more complicated by the minute. So let's take a walk down the Yellow Brick Road and find that Wizard of Oz. We're going to start with Generation Z. Generation Z is important to look at because by 2020, they will be hold about 40% of the purchasing power in the United States. They're also defining the way that social media networks shape their own feature sets. And they have some pretty strong expectations about what they want in social media and technology in general. Now, the basics, on-demand content, that's a no-brainer. Who here still goes to their cable TV as their first resource for entertainment? Not a single person. So that's not just unique to Generation Z, but for them, YouTube's the new remote control. It's the place you go for content. It is not just something that you go to for additional content. It is the place to go. And what this is also doing, the effect that this is having, is it's reshaping what celebrity means. Some of you may know who this guy is. If you do, you know he's super controversial. Probably not very brand safe for most people, but highly popular. And I picked him because I knew probably half the people in this room would know who he was, and the other half would have no clue. And that's the defining characteristic of what celebrity means to Gen Z. It's not the Leonardo DiCaprios of the world. The next item of millennial or Gen Z behavior is around control. One of the things that we're seeing is video is essentially the new way to interact. Well, not the new way, but the predominant way to interact with content. It's the majority of internet traffic. But what we're also seeing is the idea of control within the context of video. Non-linear video is something that's having a lot of traction. In this particular case, you can see that you have hotspots and links and branching. It's kind of like a choose-your-own-adventure of those books you might have read when you were a kid. For some of you, probably a little too young for that. I think a lot of those are popular in the 70s. But this is essentially the same thing, and it offers faux personalization, the opportunity to create your own path and have control over the experience itself instead of being led down the path of what the entertainment should be. Next item is social messaging. And many of you know that in 2016, social messaging far surpassed traditional social media. It was an opportunity to actually have one-to-one conversations. The reason that it became popular is because of that sense of control. I don't have to broadcast to everyone. I can have very targeted conversations with the people I want to have those conversations with. And that becomes really important when you realize, as a brand, you have to go to the places where consumers are, and they're no longer just broadcasting on the open web, on Facebook, but they're having these one-to-one conversations. And a lot of platforms realize this. WhatsApp is dominant, Facebook Messenger. But even YouTube is now incorporating direct messaging within their own app so people can communicate and have those types of conversations. This is even more important as brands realize they have to be able to account for communications both in real time and asynchronous communication. And you have to be able to do it given the expectations of Gen Z, which they have 69% of them expect to be able to interact with the brand and communicate with them one-on-one 24 hours a day. That's a big deal. Another trend. Not just group gym class, but the reshaping of what sports means, what entertainment means. Esports has become such a big industry, they now have over 300 million people watching live streams every day. That's not playing the games. That's 300 million people watching. That is larger than the audience of the NFL. If that doesn't make it big money, I don't know what does. And there are a lot of Gen Z that are now saying that they aspire to be an esports athlete versus a football athlete. In fact, there's a huge swing in that direction, A, because you don't have as many concussions, but B, because it's actually something that a lot of them have the talent to do, and there's big money behind it. In fact, in Texas, they're building a stadium specifically for esports, and a lot of sports teams are buying esports teams. The Dallas Cowboys have one, the Spurs have bought one, I believe the Seahawks are looking into buying one. And the next is the idea for millennials, or Gen Z, that the camera's the home screen. This is not new for, given the age of the audience here, most of you. I mean, working with Snapchat, Instagram, the fact that the camera is pretty much the first thing that you operate with, it's not the news feed anymore. It's not passive consumption. It's not this idea that I'm gonna sit back and see what my friends ate for lunch, but I'm gonna participate in that. I'm going to create with that. And beyond that, using the camera as a home screen, using the camera as a platform for creation. Now, the idea here is about going beyond just co-creation. In the past, recently, it was the idea of co-creating with brands. It was branded content, UGC, et cetera. But recently, it's gone to the more of the full creative control of the consumer, using things like augmented reality lenses, et cetera. And Apple and Facebook and a number of other companies are building the tools and the infrastructure to allow brands to start creating these experiences that consumers can engage in. And at this point, it's not just about co-creation. Again, it is about that full control of the experience that Gen Z really wants. And next is going towards immersive computing. And 89% of Gen Z have interacted with an augmented reality filter. Not only is it just them, but 53% of millennials have said, I would wear augmented reality glasses. Now, those of you who remember Google Glass, that's quite a statement because there was a reason people called you a glass hole if you wore those. Things have evolved a bit, but the fact that immersive computing has come so far and the technology is actually there within the phone to provide a great experience, people are interested and enticed in this type of capability. Now let's talk about social VR. If any of you have interacted with VR, actually been in a headset or been next to somebody who's in one, you know it's kind of an isolated experience. You get to stand there and watch as they're this. And it's kind of funny, like just to see them doing it, because they're so socially clueless in the context around them. But beyond that, you can't really see what's happening, even if it's on the TV. It's not as socially engaging for you. And what Facebook is doing is focusing on how they can actually bring connection to an isolated solo experience. And they're using Facebook Spaces for that, as social VR. And this particular example is about how you can interact with your teacher and your community, but it's not just what's happening as a one-to-one interaction here, the VR office hours. You'll see in a moment that other classmates are tuning in live to see this happening in real time. Now, this student might be getting the one-on-one attention and being able to get that tactile feedback of being in a classroom, But her colleagues are also getting a chance to view that content in a way that makes it even more social than just having more than one person in a social VR space at one time. Going to co-viewing, this is essentially Google's response to that. And it's about taking that experience that's in the headset, out of the headset, and putting it onto a screen. So you can connect using a Chrome stick to your TV or an Apple TV and allow people to see what you're seeing in the headset in real time. So in the living room, I might be the one in the headset, but my friends and family can also be participating and watching what's happening on the screen as I'm playing. So taking that isolated experience and making it social. Then voice. By 2020, over 50% of voice search queries will be done by voice. And honestly, we are currently in a trajectory that will eclipse that. So I think we'll have that happen sooner rather than later. And Gen Z is driving this trend beyond any other. Of course, we have Google Assistant also as part of this, so it's not just Amazon that's driving the show. But beyond this, it's not just voice commands. It's not just the ability to actually talk with your devices. Amazon and Google have recently announced that they're going to be embedding transaction within both of their within their assistants soon. So you'll be able to take voice experiences all the way through commands to an app experience to actually buying something within this device. That will have really strong implications for technology across the globe. Not only that, Google Assistant's already on 200 million devices, both Android and on iOS. That's profound. That's a way to be able to tie in so many different people to a transactional experience very quickly. Moving forward to machine vision. Now, machine vision is something that's going to change the game in a lot of different ways. You've probably seen its use in self-driving cars, in classifying organisms. In this particular case, this is someone actually going to a shop, a lot like what you would see with the Amazon Go, but instead of using sensors, they're using cameras. And this camera can actually identify the specific object someone is picking up and putting down and what they're actually doing with it. Do they have it in their hand? Have they picked it up? Are they actually unscrewing the cap? Are they eating it? What is the situation? What is the status? So it's telling you what you're actually buying. This would enable stores that don't have the infrastructure of Amazon to create kioskless and cashierless stores. This type of technology can be embedded in all sorts of applications, and as we've seen with the democratization of almost every other type of technology, eventually this is the kind of stuff you'll be able to build into apps and browsers. With that said, when you combine the power of an intelligent camera with machine vision and the voice assistant, you get what Google announced recently, or last year at Google I.O., and that is their machine vision components. You can actually engage with the device both from a vision component and a voice component, whether you're trying to identify something like a flower or get reviews for a restaurant or even sign on to the Wi-Fi. Essentially, this is creating the opportunity to create a really rich experience that's multi-sensory and provides deep context. And it's an opportunity to kind of provide a bridge between the digital and the physical, and that's huge. All right. So we've talked about a lot of the technological trends shaping what's going to be happening in the next few years. One of the things I promised in the agenda was actually looking into patents as a way forward. When we actually look into trends, we're trying to decide what's going to happen next. There are a few things that we look into beyond what people are talking about in the trends as well, and that is patent applications and job openings. And the reason we do that is because patent applications tell you what a company is thinking about, what's going to be the future of our company, and what can we do with the technology that we have today and how can we build on it. When it comes to job openings, that's how you know they're scaling an effort towards something. They're putting money on this. They're not just putting it into the patent office and saying, we think we might do this one day, and we want to protect the rights to the IP. Actually having a job opening shows that they have a department head, they have a department process, and now they need to scale. When Apple stole Google's AI chief, they didn't just do that through a job opening. They did that through backroom deals and talks, and that's how they brought them over. But when they announced the need for new engineers, that comes from a job board, and you can scan those things, and you can find where they're strategically placing their bets. So where are these companies placing their bets? Well, pretty much all of them, or Google's across the board, they're all looking at behavioral analytics except for Apple and Microsoft. Apple's made a stance that we don't do anything with your data. Microsoft, they probably have some stuff here, but not a ton. Cybersecurity is huge and really important for, of course, the timing, especially when you take a look at what's been happening in the news lately. And I'm going to kind of pick up the pace here because I know I'm running a little long. Facial recognition is by far the most universally patented technology among all of them, whether it's for cybersecurity, for purchasing, for being able to see and identify you within photos. They're all looking at your face as essentially the next interface for interaction within social media. Then, of course, cybersecurity patenting. This is a three-year rolling chart. 2014 looks like it's got the most. IP takes a while to get through, so I wouldn't say that 2017 is actually the lowest, but they're really focused on securing this technology so they don't have things like what we had recently. This is actually a patent application from Facebook being able to identify malicious actors based on your association with known malicious groups, something you'll probably see them enforcing soon. This is for Google, teleportation in AR and VR environments, the ability to actually change context very quickly. One of the things that's actually difficult is when you change your environment in augmented reality or VR, it takes you a while to become aware of your surroundings and understand your context. It fools your brain. So this technology is about how do we actually transport you to new places. And of course, you've got a little headset there. Bit of an indicator, kind of a tell. AR, Apple Maps, AR Street View. But I want to stop for a second. All this technology is really great. But one of the problems that comes with looking at technology alone is that we ignore our consumer. Oftentimes, we're so focused on chasing the different change in the algorithm, we're so focused on finding what the next feature is going to be, that we forget what our consumers are actually asking us for. And they're actually seeing it loud and clear. And when it comes to chasing those algorithms, it yields Me Too marketing. I can see what the best in-class case study is, but if I copy that, it's Me Too. I'm a second mover. I'm not creating something unique. But if I focus relentlessly on my customer and getting to know them, I can create content that does resonate and bucks the trends we were talking about earlier about organic reach and being able to get content that spreads. So I'm going to talk about how machine learning can help you do that. Now, how do we process information as humans? Conceptually, I understand that the stove is hot. Experientially, the reason I understand that is because at some point I might have gone near the stove and experienced that, holy crap, that was really hot. And then eventually I can communicate that. And as I go to other experiences where there might be something hot, my parent can tell me, no, that is hot. And I understand that as a result of my experience and the communication and the conceptual understanding of that. Now, we do something similar in the way that we train machines to understand this data, conceptually, communicatively, and experientially. And essentially, machine learning allows us to take billions and billions and billions of bytes of data and sort and create context around it, make sense of this. We've had this hurrah around big data for years now, but we don't really know what to do with it because there's so much data, it's hard to find the signal from the noise. And that's what machine learning really helps do. It refines that signal brilliantly. Now, what's great about this is the World Wide Web has become the world's largest focus group. All of a sudden, with machine learning, I have access to the comments and the statements and the actions of hundreds of millions of people. Now, it's anonymous, but at the same time, I can create an understanding of my particular consumer set, what it is that they want and need, and apply that to different models. Now, this is a little bit different than social listening. In fact, the two combine create a really powerful 1-2 punch. Social listening is really about near time. It's actually about signals and flags, being able to respond to these types of things. It's top down. Machine learning is more about going way back. We can actually go back 12, 13 years into the past, reading comments and forums and things like that to get an understanding of what people were saying and doing then and see that trend line and how it impacts the way people behave in the long run. It's a little bit more like a Rubik's Cube. I mean, it is multidimensional. The things you can pull from this are far, far more in depth, and it's bottom up. But you put these two together, and you have some really amazing opportunities. Now, we've actually done this at Epsilon. I was talking earlier about how we are data-driven marketers. And yes, it's super nerdy, and we love it. But we were actually able to look at the esports space a while ago. Esports is a new and upcoming industry, something brands are dying to get into. But there are no first-mover examples of brand case studies saying, they killed it, what did they do? So we took it to machine learning, and we actually analyzed a space that almost nobody else was in to see what is it that consumers want? Who do they identify with? What's their profile like? And we were able to create a profile on each of the different types of gamers, from gamers that were first-person shooters to racing games to fighting games. And we took that machine learning, and we applied it to what's called the OCEAN psychographic model: openness, conscientiousness, extroversion, agreeableness, neuroticism. All of a sudden, we were able to understand, what are these people like? What kind of brands should we associate with these gamers and with this sports league? And at that point in time, you can start to make connections and really sure bets on where you should be placing your money in an industry nobody knows much about. This was an opportunity for us to actually analyze fan sentiment within a sports league. And what we found was that even with the most popular teams in the entire league, there was an enormous amount of apathy. And passion in either direction is actually really good. If you hate the team, that drives conversation. If you love the team, that drives merch and revenue. But if you have apathy, it drives neither. So how do we actually get these teams to drive passion in either direction? Gave us an insight to go to these teams and say, this is what you should be doing. So what machine learning really does, it helps you strengthen the signal and reduce the noise with all the data that you have coming in through whether it's social or open web data. And with that, I want to say thank you and open it to questions in the next, 30 seconds we have? Awesome.
All right, questions. Hi, so I'm curious about, and this is going to be a little bit more of a technical question, but what data sources you use to analyze the communities within esports, mm-hmm. and then, how did you build the psychographic models? Did they take a survey? Did they engage with some sort of a test or something like that?
That's a great question. So the psychographic modeling itself was actually an already established framework from the psychiatry community, the OCEAN model. What we did to actually attribute certain characteristics of these individuals to that psychographic model is we went into things like forums, Amazon reviews, any place where we could get open text to pull in around conversations relevant to the concept of esports and video games. And what we were able to do is actually follow entire conversations and strings and threads across multiple individuals, in fact, tens of thousands of individuals, and even see when one person posts one time, 50 times, 100 times, you're able to get a very rich understanding of who that person is and what they do and what they think and what they like. And you're able to use that anonymous data to then start to say, okay, given your demographic you're going after, they kind of fit this general profile. They fit a little bit more on the extroversion. So they're probably a little bit more like the Red Bull profile. This one's a little bit more on the conscientious, neurotic. They're probably a little bit more reserved and laid back. So that the types of brands you would bring into that type of situation would be different.
What other questions do we have?
Hey, so you mentioned a lot of big trends that are mm-hmm. coming up. What of all these trends you mentioned, which one do you think is kind of the most significant, and which one should we kind of take hold of to try to keep up?
I would definitely say camera as a platform. It's the one that has the quickest win. It's something you can already take advantage of. The fact that everyone's engaging with Snapchat, Instagram, and with the filters, that's a good place to start. By playing in that space, you'll be able to keep track of where that's heading and what kind of infrastructure and tools that these companies are building. And they're betting the farm on video and the camera. So that's where they're pushing all of their efforts. That's where I would put my money.
My question actually kind of ties into that mm-hmm. about using your camera. Like, you know, one day you'll be able to open your camera and find out what kind of plant that is, or what kind of cloud mm-hmm. that is, or what constellation, whatever. Where do you see the line being drawn on, like, the privacy and human side of that? It kind of ties in even with Google Maps and blurring out people's faces and stuff mm-hmm. like that. Will that data, or, you know, the fact that you use your camera to check reviews for that restaurant, like, if there's people in that shot, how does that get, where's the privacy side of that?
Yeah, these are really important design decisions. When you design technology, you're also influencing the way people will interact with that technology. You're making decisions for people when you design things, and that's why I think the study of design is becoming more and more ever important when we're actually building these tools. I don't know where that line's going to be drawn, and I guarantee you it is going to be crossed a couple of times before the industry gets it right. In fact, we're already seeing that. Things that were designed originally with the best of intentions were being used in ways that were less than positive when it comes to things like, you know, the use of the developer platform. Now, Facebook designed their developer platform, the ability for developers to actually get your friends' information as a native feature of the developer platform. That wasn't something that Cambridge Analytica hacked. It was an actual feature of the Facebook platform. They designed that so they could get scale. And they designed it so they get more developers on the platform, and so they could build a business around that. Now, did they design it so that they could also be weaponized? I guarantee you they didn't. But that's something that you have to think about, especially these companies when they have so much scale and so much control. What is the actual implication of your design? What kind of impact will it have besides just the positive impact you're hoping it will have? So the answer is, it will happen, and I don't know what that's gonna look like. That's a great question that we'll probably have to see played out over and over again. Thank you.
All right, as we're waiting for, we have time for a couple more questions. So, oh, great, Chris, thank you.
Based on what's coming next, mm-hmm. what are the, I'm thinking of like social media marketers, the daily tasks and strategies that we implement.
Yep.
What will be irrelevant in 5 years?
Oh man, that's a great question. I think the way that we gather insights right now will look archaic in 5 years. A lot of the analysis tools that we have, the data points that we're looking at, oftentimes we have to kind of settle for vanity metrics as a way of attributing ROI. We have to say, well, we got this much engagement, it got this much traction online, we think we can attribute it this much to this percentage lift in sales. In some cases, you actually have full insight all the way through the line, but for a lot of brands and companies, that's a pipe dream. I think the line between social and actual ROI will eventually get stronger. I think that what actually social media means will blur a lot more, but at the same time, I think with things like machine learning, and the ability to take that data and model algorithms against it, a lot of the decision making that analysts do now will be automated in a way that provides actually actionable insights, and in some cases the machines will be able to act on it for you instead of you having to go and create a campaign around it.
So I'm just curious about how Epsilon came to be. Like, where does mm-hmm. a company like that, that's very data driven, and all that, like, how does that come to be? Where did that get inspired from? And
wow. So we've actually been around for 48 years now. We've been doing big data for about 45 of those. So we've been doing it before it was big data. Our main initial clients were actually the Limited, back when they were trying to actually implement credit card programs and processing. So we've been doing data, processing, banking, you name it, for a long time. In fact, most people know us. We like to joke that we're the largest agency you've never heard of. We're 9,000 people. We are global. We're about we're lots of billions in revenue. But most people don't know us as an agency. And that's because until about 8 years ago, we really weren't an agency. We were a data company, a CRM company, email. We had an automotive vertical and a few other different lines of business through loyalty. So we do a lot of these things that create the infrastructure of all the things that brands do. But there wasn't an agency component. So ended up buying a bunch of agencies. Rolling them together and creating an agency arm of Epsilon. And what we do is we leverage that massive trove of data, largest transactional data set in the world, larger than Google's, massive, massive data set on consumers. And we use that to generate insights, to generate personas on who our consumers are, to make sure that we really know who we're dealing with. So we use what we like to call the data of identity, the things that don't change about you, your dress, your phone number, your name, and match that with things like the data of culture, which is social media data. Open web data, to start to create a rich and in-depth profile of who we want to deal with and what is it they want, so we can create really effective advertising.
Pretty cool stuff. So one last thing, and I'm thinking about like what we would be thinking in the audience too. In addition to this talk, I mean, does the company offer any type of resources for organizations to dig into, anywhere that they can go to get like free resources or anything that you guys offer to kind of educate them about your company, but also about what's going on in the world?
Absolutely. Our website's decent. It's one of those things where the cobbler's children have no shoes. A lot of agencies do amazing work, and then their actual website could use a little bit of work. As far as resources, there are a lot of people like myself in the agency that publish a lot of content. Two of my colleagues in the audience here, Jeremy Olkin and Steve Harries, do a lot of publishing of content on their own. My boss, Tom Edwards, who's our chief digital officer, is prolific. So honestly, if you look for Epsilon on the social media interwebs, you'll find a lot of the stuff that we do produce, and a lot of it has to do with the bread and butter of what we do on a daily basis, things like the machine learning and looking at design, et cetera. And I highly recommend and encourage you guys to check that out. One more in the back.
So you spoke a lot about the future of social media, especially how it relates to millennials and Gen Z, mm-hmm. And all of that was very much focused on technology for obvious reasons. I'm curious as to what the future of social media looks like for baby boomers, because mm-hmm. like that's who I'm primarily selling to. And I mean, my parents can barely operate the phone on their own camera. I'm not really sure how they're going to get into like VR and AR.
Yep. It's something that as any marketer who has to deal with, who deals with clients that are focused on baby boomers and older, you'll often get the argument, well, they don't do things on smartphones and they're not on the internet. And that was true in 2010, 2011. But if you take a look at where they are now, that's not so much true. Now, there are definitely people who have trouble with operating technology. My mom was one of them. She used to call me and ask me which one's the play button on the DVD player. And now she has the whole house wired up on AirPlay. Like, she really took the deep dive. And what's happening is they're learning from their children who have been growing up with this technology. So it's kind of, it's a slow bleed into the other generations, but it is happening. In fact, my dad is now buying all of his tickets on mobile and operating, sending me Venmos every once in a while. So they're starting to pick up our behaviors as a result of that. So I wouldn't say that like a super tech forward campaign would really resonate with them, but actually being able to push them onto social channels, because they do operate in social channels. Tons of them are on Facebook. They love email. How many of you get emails from your parents sharing news articles and things like that? There are ways to reach them through those digital channels. They tend to be a little bit more traditional in the way they operate and how much they're willing to give up their information to communicate with you. They wouldn't be on Snapchat, for sure. But I tend to challenge clients to say, no, we're not going to do something that's mobile first or mobile only, because they're not on it. I'm like, how many of them still have flip phones? Most of them have smartphones. Most of them are on Android and Apple.
Yeah, it's a good point, because my father-in-law got Google Now, one of those things, for Christmas, and he wanted it. Like, he just, like, I saw it in the news. It looks pretty cool. So it's funny, because I'm totally educating him, because he'll go to it and be like, okay, Google, so I was thinking about some things the other day, and I'm curious if you have any thoughts about, like, he'll just have this conversation. And yes. Of course, he's like, I'm sorry, I don't understand. I'm like, no, you got to ask, like, just one-liner questions or whatever. It's funny. So he's still
learning.
That's
common. I've seen that a couple times.
Yeah, exactly. So, okay, so we're out of time. But, Ian, thank you so much. Good to hear from you again. Thank you.